Martin Gurry is a former CIA analyst who writes about the relationship between politics and media. Gurry was born in Cuba and came to the United States with his parents in the 1950s. In 2014, he self-published an e-book titled The Revolt of the Public and the Crisis of Authority in the New Millennium. It was republished in hardback 4 years later in 2018. Martin Gurry says his thesis is a simple one. The information technologies of the 21st century have enabled the public, composed of amateurs, people from nowhere, to break the power of political hierarchies of the industrial age.
We assume you're here because you enjoy listening to C-SPAN's podcasts. If you're a regular listener, please consider supporting our nonprofit operation so we can continue to bring you quality public affairs podcasts like these. Visit cspan.org/donate to learn more.
Martin Gurry, what was it like working for the CIA for 28 years?
Well, you can imagine there were a lot of changes during that time. The CIA is it's one of the organizations that I describe in my book, The Revolt of the Public. It's a hierarchy. It's essentially modeled on the Cold War as being the fundamental encounter that we're supposed to meet. The funny thing happens to an organization when it mirrors an opponent as long as the CIA did the Soviet Union. It becomes a little bit like that. You're so used to anticipating the other side that you become a little like that. I always felt CIA had the touch of the Politburo to it. Brilliant people. Courageous people. In the lobby of CIA, they have these stars that symbolize people who have died in service. No names, just stars. They way more than doubled during my tenure. All right, these are people who are very dedicated. But the institution itself, I was in. I always say the least sexy corner of CIA. I was an analyst of global media. I didn't have a license to kill. The beautiful ladies never threw themselves at me. Nobody ever made a movie about my work. But as part of that great organization, I felt like we went through the end of the Cold War, which, by the way, surprised CIA immensely. They were not predicting that. And we went through 9/11, and I would say those are two fairly epic moments in my career.
When did you retire?
2010.
And what are you doing now?
This? I mean, I basically write a lot. The book has been a tremendous blessing for me. I have met so many intelligent persons, such as yourself, that are interested in having conversations with me. I work with, I'm a visiting fellow for Mercatus Center. And that pretty much describes my relationship with that group, which is also, by the way, chock full of smart and learned people, many of them, an amazing number. I'm a fellow that visits Mercatus. So visiting fellow, I think, it's a perfect description. Do I write for Discourse, which is their magazine, a wonderful magazine that I recommend to everybody. And I write for other periodicals like a City Journal and so forth. Essentially, my interest is to see how far the ideas in the book parse out as events collide with those ideas. Of how far do they falsify the ideas? How far do they agree with them?
Plenty of time to talk about the book, but I want to ask about your transition from Cuba to the United States. How did that happen? Under what circumstances? And when?
Right. The year was 1960. I was a relatively young person of 11 years old, barely. My father was a lawyer. Apolitical. Castro had taken over. He'd been there not quite 2 years. And essentially, in a country that has no law, lawyers were unnecessary. My father, thank goodness, was a very perceptive man, and he saw what was coming. All the companies that were his clients were being nationalized. So he and my sister, my mother was pregnant with my sister, and for various reasons, we had American visas. But if the baby had been born in Cuba, that was it. There was no way she was ever going to get a visa. So I am very thankful for my younger sister, because she and my dad helped get me out of Cuba. So I was a young man. Culturally, it was not a big deal. And Cuba was a fairly moderate. If you were a middle class Cuban, like my family and my friends, we watched the same TV shows, the same movies, same music, you know, rock and roll. I remember blaring from Elvis Presley, trying to memorize those words in English without knowing a word of what they meant. Of course, there's always the sense that you are the last of a line, and you have come from this culture. And now you've entered a very different culture. But this is an amazing country. And I always say, at some point, I don't know how it happens, but you start talking about George Washington and Thomas Jefferson as your forefathers, even though they're really clearly not on your family tree. You know what I mean? So I feel like I have always been tremendously grateful to the United States. I have always felt for most of my life that I forget that I'm an immigrant. I forget I'm not there. There are no harsh reminders that I'm an immigrant. And I have been allowed to, fulfill my wishes insofar as my meager talents allow them to. And I have trouble understanding people who see this country as gigantically oppressive, discriminatory, and so forth, because that was not my experience.
Where did you grow up?
We spent the obligatory year in Miami. And the second thing I am most thankful to my dad for is he got us out of there. So I did not grow up in a Cuban ghetto. I grew up in Falls Church, Virginia, outside Washington, D.C., My wife went to the same high school I did. I've lived my entire life. We moved from Falls Church to Vienna, mighty Vienna, Virginia, which is about maybe 10 miles away. And that, except for a brief moment where I was assigned to Paraguay, Asunción, Paraguay, we've lived there our entire lives.
Where'd you go to school?
George Mason.
And Mercatus is... how much connected to George Mason, and what does it do?
It's totally connected to George Mason. I think everybody there is, except us visiting fellows just visit, but most of the core group of scholars there are teaching professors. And it's a research center that they produce research papers having to do with policy and such. I have said it to their faces, so I don't think I'm talking behind their backs. These kind of all the think tanky places in Washington is full of think tanks, all right? I don't understand the concept very well of a think tank. You pay people to think. I mean, it sounds kind of nice, but what's the point of this? And they generate all kinds of papers. I think at a certain moment in history, when it was clear that the Republicans were going to be politically powerful, but were policy poor, those think tanks produced a lot of policy papers. But we're talking the Reagan era now. I think right now, all those think tanks have only multiplied. I'm kind of an odd duck in the Washington world. I don't really understand that. I think research, which is what Mercatus does, makes the most sense of all of them. But it's a bit mysterious to me, to be true.
So how did you get a job with the CIA, and why did it interest you?
It didn't. I mean, that was the strangest thing. Of all the unusual twists that my life has taken, that's probably one of the most. There was an ad in a paper in the Washington Post that was not seen by me, but by a friend of a friend of a friend who, through a long chain, eventually got to my wife, who said, "This is perfect. This is about translation." It was a translation from Spanish. I said, "CIA, you're crazy." And she goes, "No, go and apply. What can it hurt?" I said, "Well, I She said, I'll do your resume. My wife, if you want to get a job, get my wife to do your resume. Okay. So she did my resume. I got in. I thought I had no chance. I had no particular interest. Once I got in, I loved the work. I mean, the work was fascinating. We had a shop that looked at the entire global media, if necessary, in translation. You could just say, translate this article. I mean, from any language, almost certainly, I would say, the most powerful translation shop in the world. And contrary to the culture of CIA and to the movies and popular belief, I would say, I don't think, again, I'm giving away any secrets, 80% of the information in the world, including inside CIA, comes from open sources. And it's more every day.
Who would you credit in your career with having some of the best organizations presenting news and information around the world and in the United States?
I would say in the old days, that's a tricky question. I'm not a believer in news. I believe that the news is, I'm not sure what that is. Define to me what news is. I believe in information. And news as a category of information is basically self-defined. If it shows up in a newspaper or in a TV news broadcast, it's news, otherwise not. And there was many years ago, I think about 20 years ago, an effort to protect journalists who were being compelled by law enforcement to reveal their sources so that you could legally protect them. And that kind of foundered because nobody could quite define what a journalist was, right? So if I am online and I am writing about events, am I a journalist? So, but, if, you know, not to get too snooty about this. In the olden days, I'd say BBC probably had the best media operation and the most austere take on the news and the most complete around the world. Part of what is, I think, and it always has been pathetically insufficient about American news is that we tend to beat on three or four themes and ignore the rest of the world. BBC is, you know, I don't know whether it's the legacy of the empire or what. I have been to Bush House because my there was an arrangement between BBC monitoring and my agency at CIA. And everybody spoke with the most impeccable Oxbridge accent, but they came from 100 different countries. I mean, it was kind of remarkable. So they pay attention to the world because I think once they owned most of it, right?
The book, The Revolt of the Public, it seems to me, and maybe this is not fair to you, but it seems to me to be one of those word-of-mouth books that you and explain. And the reason I say this is that somebody said, have you heard about this? And then somebody said that somebody else said to them, and it just kind of passed along. And in your introduction, Dr. Kling, if he is a doctor, writes an introduction and says that Virginia Pastrell wrote a column and that's where he got the idea, but he's also at Mercatus. So I'm going through all this and want you to tell us how this all started back in the it was published in 2014. Give us the background on how this happened.
Yeah, actually, it's another weird story. I think my life is kind of littered with those. When I was in CIA, it was already clear to not just me, but to many, many smart people inside my particular agency that the world was changing. The world of information was changing. It was changing dramatically. That this this earthquake of information, of digital information, you know, epicenter somewhere, Mountain View, El Paso, who knows, had generated this tsunami of information that had completely overwhelmed the old authoritative sources that we used to have. I mean, in the old days, if the president said, what's the media in France saying about my policies? You went to two newspapers. You went to Le Monde. You went to Le Figaro and done, okay? Suddenly in France, you had thousands of sources, some of which had seemed to have very interesting information. We had no idea who they were. So to make a short story long, I and several of us kept telling CIA we're missing the boat on this. We need to change our procedures, which were based for very, very narrow bands of information, and figure out some way to deal with this enormous, you know, tsunami. Well, it didn't work. So when I left, I thought, okay, now I'm going to, you know, put my money where my mouth is, and I'm going to write a book doing the kind of analysis I would have done if I could have done it in CIA. And, you know, I love research. Nothing more fun than doing research, because you always start out thinking you know, and by the end you realize how little you do know, and you've changed your mind about 100 things because the data has told you that what you initially assumed was wrong. So in the year 2014, I finished the book. I tossed it into Amazon, and it kind of sold a trickle here, a trickle there. Virginia's review was very generous. But basically what made the book was Donald Trump. I am a Trump profiteer. You know, I'm not alone. I think the New York Times is probably the most guilty of this, but I am a Trump profiteer. The night that he got elected in 2016, my smartphone just erupted. It's like, oh, Martin Gurry has won this election or something. You know, I mean, it's strange, strange stuff. A couple of years later, I got an email from somebody called Patrick Collison, I'd never heard of, and said, I want to publish your book for real. And I got all kinds of, you know, if you give me $10,000 to publish your book type emails. So I thought this was going to be like that. I look up Patrick Collison. He's 21 years old at the time, and he's worth like $1.5 billion. He's the CEO of Stripe, and he wants to start a whole new branch of Stripe called Stripe Press. Very innovative. Very, he's out in San Francisco, very, very Silicon Valley. And so I said yes. And then I added a very long essay called Reconsiderations at the end of my initial book. And that book has sold a lot of copies. I mean, it has sold a lot of copies. And I call myself, you know, like, I'm kind of like Dr. Doom, you know, like whenever things start to go really bad, like this is a particular kind of a bad moment, you know, wars are breaking, the Republicans can't get themselves to elect a speaker. Well, everybody comes to me for some reason, you know, that when times are good, I am forgotten. So the day you don't hear from me anymore, that would be a really good time.
So am I right that this was dumped into Amazon as an ebook in 2014, yep, and then published in 2018 by Stripe, yep, which is based in San Francisco? And then when did you add the reconsiderations chapter, long chapter, that's it suggested at the beginning of the book? You read it at first, and yes, then you go back and read it again.
Yeah, that was the 2018 edition. And you're right. It has been word of mouth, but in not just, you know, people in the street, word of mouth as we're doing right now, for example. I have been in a lot of podcasts, and a certain kind of person seems to take to the book. A certain kind of person seems just never to get it. I am a hero in Silicon Valley. I've met lots of billionaires. I am a zero in Washington, D.C., which is where I worked my entire life, right? So the people in Washington, which are ensconced in these hierarchical, slow-moving, old-fashioned institutions, it's not that they are hostile to the ideas. It's like I'm talking Mandarin to them. They just don't understand what I'm saying. I can just see my mouth is moving and their eyes are getting bigger and bigger. They do not get it. They do not get it. You know, your C-SPAN, is that right? I mean, you're kind of breaking ranks amongst the elites, because most people in Washington just simply, I've never been reviewed in the Washington Post, never been reviewed in the New York Times, sold a lot of copies.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets,
Science, Culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Well, first of all, we're not a member of the elite, but I do want to ask you about that word because you use it a lot in your book.
Yeah.
Define it. Who are the elites?
Yes, I have very clear definitions. And that's funny because when I wrote the book, of course, it wasn't in currency. Right now, everybody talks about it, and it gets a little tricky to figure out what it is that people mean by that word. I had a very clear, specific definition. The elites are the people who manage the institutions that essentially make the modern world function. Okay, and by manage, I mean belong to. So, you know, of course, government and politics, but also corporations, but also academia, but also media, but also the scientific establishment. And there's a particular mindset that comes with that. You can be, you know, the most the lowest member of the totem pole in some university, some kind of associate professor, whatever, sitting in a cafe that the owner makes probably 10 times what you make and that owns that cafe, but you feel superior to that person because you belong to that institution. You are part of this elite group, and you have these rules of behavior and these shared ideals and shared opinions that make you an elite. When I wrote the book, it was pretty clear that the elites were dead set against what I call the forces that have led to the revolt of the public, the digital sort of flattening of information. And that has only become more apparent since we've had all these attempts to censor social media and pretty successful ones, I have to say, that have come out in Twitter files, for example.
I want to read you a quote from your book. This is a pet peeve of mine. Some people will laugh when I read this as if it doesn't matter, but it jumped out at the page to me. You say, in a few short years, the political landscape has been transformed into a bedlam of irreconcilable factions. Violent and profane language that would have been unthinkable in 2014 is routinely used. What are you talking about?
Well, I mean, nowadays you have even politicians, you know, dropping F-bombs and essentially behaving in a way that schoolyard kids in my day, I mean, if you talk that way to somebody, you better get ready to, you know, get into a fight, right? It's a measure of the collapse of the old world, the hierarchical world that I, as not a young person, as you can see, lived in probably most of my life. A world in which the hierarchy actually formed you, and you abided by the rules of that hierarchy. I think that has been swept away by the tsunami. I think the institutions have become very performative. So in this babble of voices, what Jonathan Haidt calls it the Tower of Babel, the only way you are heard is by being extreme and using, but you have to be the loudest shouter, and you have to have the most enemies on the other side shouting back at you so that people notice. And you have to have the most extreme language so that everybody is startled. It's structural. This is basically, you will not be heard. If you're the voice of moderation, you will sink to the bottom and nobody will pay attention.
You have any idea where this first started?
I mean, it is a function of the loss of control by the elites of the conversation. And that is 100%, you could say, the turn of the century, when the digital began to have a serious effect on the information structure.
I'm going to jump to a crisis of authority chapter and read the first paragraph.
Okay.
You say the street protests of 2011, while ostensibly political, were part of a global assault on the guardians of authority across every domain of human activity. The protesters stood in the same relation to the government that bloggers and social media did to newspapers, YouTube to television, Napster to the recording industry, massive online courses to universities, Amazon to shopping malls, the open science movement to the scientific establishment. From the commanding heights of the information sphere, the public sought in each case to break a monopoly held by an accredited elite. Have they done that?
Yes, but is the answer. Yeah. I think when you look at the volumes of information, I mean, that when I was a young media analyst, as I said before, if open information was a trickle. Starting, I mean, if you look at the year 2001, the volume of information produced in 2001 was double the amount produced in all of previous history, going back to cave paintings and the dawn of culture. 2002, double 2001. If you follow that trajectory, and it sort of has, on a, you know, not quite, but has continued on that basis, if you chart that, it really does look like a gigantic wave, a tsunami. There is no way our hierarchies, which were constructed in the 20th century to manage and monopolize trickles of information, can control this gigantic flood. It has escaped them. What is authoritative today is up for grabs. Everything up to including what is true.
Explain this. The New York Times has 10 million people that signed up for their digital service, which is a lot bigger than they ever were before digital. But in television, everybody has lost audience, a lot of audience. I mean, 60 Minutes used to have an audience of, say, 30 million on a Sunday night. Now they have on an average of 7 million on a Sunday night. Why did the New York Times have a bigger audience in this world now compared to what television is?
Well, remember what I said. I call myself a Trump profiteer, but I mean, I am a piker compared to the New York Times. All right. The New York Times in the year 2015, say, before Trump sort of came down that golden escalator, had its numbers of digital subscribers was under a million. By the end of the Trump administration, it was 8 or 9 million. You say 10 now, that may well be true. It is a question in my mind that, I mean, Trump is still there, and he may, for all we know, be president again. But at some point, I mean, he's fortunately not immortal, so he politically certainly not immortal. He will vanish. I am not at all certain that that large audience of the New York Times will survive the loss of Donald Trump. But if you want to know the why of it, I would recommend a book by possibly the most brilliant media analyst that I know of, Andre Meir, called Post-Journalism, in which he explains very carefully how journalism has transitioned from the facade being I am providing objective news to an audience that are really eyeballs for advertisers. So you don't want to alienate anybody by taking these real strong positions, to being almost a purveyor of a creed. I am the protected garden that if you are a liberal or a progressive, you come to my paywalled garden, we shut the doors and we give you the words that encourage you and that you can then spout back and confront those devilish Trumpists out there. It is entirely a different model. It can be, as Andre says, done by only one. You can only have one church. You can't have 20 churches of anti-Trump. So all the other newspapers are dying. The Washington Post just posted a $100 million loss. So how long can that even be sustained by the New York Times? I'm not sure. But the model, the post-journalistic model, you have to give them credit. You know, they have essentially covered, for example, the Russia-Trump controversy, things that turned out to be false. In other words, they had literal thousands of articles in the New York Times about Trump being an agent of the Russians. And almost every one of those articles, he was culpable. Turned out that, you know, the investigations were done, the report came out, nope, there was nothing there. But it was a big success for the New York Times. You may think it was a journalistic failure. It was not. During that time, their online subscriptions went up by 2 or 3 million. So it's a good business model.
In your book, you use Alan Greenspan to make a point.
Yes.
What is it?
Well, he is the man who knew everything about the economy. The elites of the 20th century, their pose is that they are scientific. They are experts. They are accredited. Society is too complex to be left to the amateurs. That, by the way, is 100% true. The problem is the elites don't know as much as they think they do. They certainly don't know as much as they tell us that they do. And Alan Greenspan, who was called, I think, the conductor, so the maestro, that's what it was, in a book that was written about him, because he conducted the economy like a maestro, was forced after 2008 to say in front of Congress that he had no clue about what had happened. And if you read what everybody was saying, I mean, starting from George W. Bush down many, many levels of important people making decisions during that crisis, the question they were asking was, how could this happen? Well, it could happen because we did not know as much about complex systems as the experts think that they do, and as they tell us that they do. The pandemic is another good example. And in the olden days, that could be managed because all the information was essentially in the hands of the elites themselves. Today, it cannot be managed. We are watching them center stage, tell us one thing one moment, the opposite the next moment, a third thing a moment later, and pretend that they know everything about what's going on. So if you're Anthony Fauci and you're going back and forth, people are seeing you. There's a complete erosion of trust that's going on because the information system is way too big for you to control in the way that they would have done in the 20th century.
There's a word that you use in your book to describe what's going on in the society that you wrote back in 2014. I don't know when I started seeing it other places, but certainly most recently, and that is the word nihilism. What is nihilism, and how important is that to what's going on in our society?
Yeah, that's a funny one because, you know, if you're an analyst, you really measure your words. I mean, you really put them on a little scale and go, is this really? And I had qualms about some of the words that I use, and I had probably the most qualms about nihilism because it seems kind of sensationalistic. But, you know, if you look at it and it looks like that word or what it describes, then I went with it. And now, of course, everybody uses the word pretty promiscuously. Of course, the word goes back to Turgenev, the Russian novelist, a novel called Fathers and Sons. And there's a character in it, whose name now escapes me, but doesn't really matter, who believes that society needs to be destroyed to the ground. And when he gets asked, but what are you going to build on it? He goes, doesn't matter. The first step is destroy society to the last stick. All right. Much of the reaction against the elites, nobody can call me a fan of the elites, but when the public erupts against the elites, when people who claim to represent the public, usually called populists, people like Trump, lift up their swords against the elites, they are against their stand is 100% against. They want to bash at the institutions. They want to strike at what they consider to be privileged, smug, self-righteous people that are always calling them, you know, names like racists and, you know, basically disrespecting everybody who is not one of them. But they have no programs. They have, first of all, no real organization, no real structure, no real programs, not really even an ideology, a coherent ideology. They usually, these revolts from the public and these populists tend to have a flavor. So Trump is kind of like a right-wing flavor. I mean, he is not programmatic anything, right? Trump seems to change his mind as the wind blows. So, I mean, a nihilist is somebody or a group, a condition, which is what we have today, I would say, of revolt against an established system that has reached such a level of emotional intensity that those in revolt want to do, as in the Russian novel, smash every stick down to the ground, but have not a thought in their heads about what to put in its place. And of course, we need hierarchies, we need institutions to get anything achieved in a complicated society.
Tell us more about the success of this book. Are you selling hundreds of thousands of this book?
40,000.
And what are the most interesting things that have come back to you because of the book? People's reactions, articles written, all that kind of stuff. What's the tale? This is a 10-year process.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting one. Particularly these times where everybody is so basically in a corner and attacking the other corner, and there's very little middle ground. I always felt as an analyst, I guess the CIA teaches you this, is that you are not to, you know, if somebody can tell what your political leanings are from your analysis, you failed, right? So the book has had a funky career that way, in that it seems to appeal to whoever is not in office at the time. So when Trump was in office, a lot of the old Obamaites were interested in the book and would call me up. Since Biden has won, it's been almost entirely the other side that has been interested. But in an era of, you know, canceling and whatnot, I seem, both in my book and in my writings, incapable to get anybody angry at me. I don't know what the hell it is about the way I write. I've tried. I actually have tried, because I figure everybody gets angry at you and starts yelling at you immediately. You become a celebrity or something, right? I can't do it. I have, not for lack of trying, but I can't do it. So the book has had a remarkable career for me, in that it has brought nothing but good things. Nothing but good things. I have met so many amazing people through it, many of whom have become actual personal friends. I have traveled, you know, there was a moment when the French, they're still halfway there, can't figure out what the heck is happening in their own country. If you know anything about France, that's unusual in their history. The French, I've been there many times, so I was there when I was young. The French used to be the other way around. They would tell us Americans what was wrong with us, right? This is what you're missing, right? But after the yellow vests and everything that has happened since, that doesn't fit into their political schemes, which are pretty old fashioned. So I spent one year where I kept being invited to France. I mean, this is not bad. And I always make it a condition: you have to bring my wife with me. I'm not going to go over there. I'm too old to be alone. So, and sure, bring her along. So it's been kind of like that. It's been an amazing adventure. And then throwing out the ideas and watching things evolve, so watching the elites strike back, you know, the empire strikes back, with the pandemic being kind of like the model. If you generate a crisis that's harsh enough, you can make the public frightened enough to obey you again. And so that model has, you know, disinformation is terrifying. So you have to somehow control that. Or white supremacy is terrifying. So you have to somehow control that. So seeing my ideas kind of mutate, and seeing the people that I characterize take different strategies to get over the landscape that I described, It's been all good. I have no complaints.
Why is Walter Lippmann a character in your book?
I mean, he was a brilliant man. He was the one who defined. I was trying to figure out who is it that we're talking about when I say the words "the public," and the public is not the people. The people is essentially a category of political philosophy that doesn't really exist. Although every time the public hits the street, it claims to be the people, as it never fails. It's not the masses. That's an old sociological term from the 20th century. It's barely even the crowd, although since the smartphone, the crowd and the public are pretty tightly connected. What Walter Lippmann said is the public is any group that is interested in a particular affair. So the affair could be getting rid of Emmanuel Macron if you are a yellow vest. It could be getting rid of capitalism if you are an Occupy Wall Street. It could be getting rid of Mubarak, the Egyptian dictator, if you are in the middle of the Arab Spring in Tahrir Square. There is no single public. There are publics. If I had any intellectual integrity, that's what I would use. But, you know, it just sounds ugly. So I call it the public. And it is the public that has been essentially been empowered by the digital platforms. It is a network public opposed to a hierarchical set of institutions from the 20th century. And curiously enough, Walter Lippmann pretty much defined the mindset of those institutions. Walter Lippmann was literally a Platonist. He believed that there was such a thing as Platonic truth, and that if you were of a certain intellectual elite, you could perceive it, and despaired of the public, as he defined it, of understanding, because he identified the public with the citizenry, and he thought that there had to be an all-competent public if they were going to decide at election time, you know, what policies needed to be implemented in terms of what candidates they elected. And he despaired of that. He thought that that could not happen. He was a tremendous elitist. So he both gave me the definition for the public and created the ultimate model for elitism, which is expertise. And this was, of course, back in the 1920s, when it was kind of a radical idea that the U.S. government, for example, should gather statistics about its economic activities. You know, so there was a lot of this elitism that was smart. They were moving with the times. Those were the times for it. Unfortunately, 100-plus years later, it's obsolete.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. We're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Your chapter, The Finale for Skeptics, first paragraph, my thesis, again, is a simple one. The information technologies of the 21st century have enabled the public, just talking about that, composed of amateurs, people from nowhere, to break the power of political hierarchies of the industrial age. What's an amateur?
Well, an amateur is somebody who, if you're talking about science, for example, you know, climate change, for example, or the economy, for example, doesn't have a set of PhD degrees from the best universities on those particular subjects. It's people from nowhere, like I said. It's if I were to opine on astronomy or on nuclear physics, I would obviously be a complete amateur in that. So we have a structure of society that was put in place in the 20th century that just rose up people who were multi accredited and equated accreditation with wisdom and knowledge. And I think although you have to have some knowledge and some of those people are possibly wise as a class in the contemporary moment of the information structure that is digital and the tsunami is battering away, they are not wise. They are very reactionary. They are very backwards looking. They want their 20th century back.
Because you spent 28 years in the CIA analyzing global media, what countries of the world are closed and that the public doesn't get to see enough information to really understand what's going on in the world?
Oh, most of them. I mean, the good thing about the digital environment is, you know, seek and you shall find. If you are interested in a country, you can always find information, sometimes trustworthy, sometimes less so, about that country online. But we are, in the old days of the narrow stream of information, I believe the media actually covered more, for example, international news than today with our gigantic tsunami battering away. So, I mean, just to give one example that I think is a fascinating one, the country of Chile. Country of Chile is like a laboratory of the ideas in my book, okay? Why is the public in revolt? The ideas are usually, well, economic reasons, or, you know, the inequality usually brought up, or political reasons, and tyranny is usually brought up. But you look at a country like Chile, and you say to yourself, well, how did this happen? Chile was by far the most prosperous country in Latin America for like 25, 30 years. It had entered the Club of Rich Nations. It had a really viable democracy so that socialists and conservatives kind of alternated in power. And then in 2019, they had this thing called the estallido social, the social blow up, where started by the fact that the government had raised the cost of public transport by, I think, 4 or 5%. I mean, tiny, tiny pennies. Millions, hundreds of millions worth of damage in the riots that ensued. A million people in the streets of Santiago opposed to something or other. Dozens died. But what happened was, for once, the nihilist side, the public, was given a chance to be positive. They elected a president. There was a presidential election that came along, and the person who got elected had long hair and tattoos. He was a lifelong protester. He was, I think, 30 at the time. And they convened a constitutional convention that was totally dominated by the protesters, right? So the Constitution, I mean, if you want to read that, it's not like they have no ideas about what to change. It's that they have no coherent ideology to organize those ideas. The Constitution was 300 pages long, and it was full of tremendous declarations of, you know, virtue about, you know, the Aboriginal Chileans should get sovereignty, but nothing was defined, nothing was clarified. They had won the support of the voting public in Chile. They had both the presidency and the Constitutional Assembly had been voted in. By the time that they came up with this constitution, it got voted down by like 65%. It was a crazy document. It made no sense. The president today is very unpopular. He put a doctor in charge of somebody who had a woman who had distinguished herself. It's kind of like a charitable person during the pandemic as in charge of the Ministry of Interior, which takes care of the police. So that, of course, it was a symbolic gesture that the carabineros, the police in Chile, these were protesters. They didn't like them. And now they have a tremendous crime problem. And now she's backtracking and trying to solve the crime problem. So I wish this was reported in our media in the way that it should be. This is a fascinating experiment. Everybody who's protesting around the world, and by the way, the characteristics of the public and of the elites in every country are amazingly similar. The structural pressures, I think, make them that way. You could have put the Chilean protesters in New York. They could have been Occupy Wall Street, or you could have put them in France. They could have been the Yellow Vest. But here they got to be positive, and they couldn't do it. They simply could not do it. So I wish we had more coverage of, you know, Latin America, Asia, even Europe. Our coverage of Europe is only insofar as it touches us or it touches our politics. So if you happen to be pro-populist, you know, you're a Trumpist or something like that, you follow the populist overseas and you cheer them on and vice versa. But you never totally understand other countries on their own terms, which is what you should do. And coming from CIA, of course, that's what CIA tried to do.
In your book, you have a contrast between the story of JFK and the Bay of Pigs, which was a failure, and Barack Obama. Tell us the background on that, please.
Yeah, I mean, I find that to be a really good analytic tool, is because we get so embedded into the present, is go back and say, how do people handle presidential failure and then and now? So my example was of the Bay of Pigs, which was, in hindsight, a ridiculous idea. They had 3,000 people trained by CIA, invaded Cuba, a country at the time, I think, had 7 million people, and had a military force. There's no way that was ever going to triumph. I mean, I think maybe the idea originally under a previous president, because the whole thing was set into motion to begin with by Eisenhower. I think the idea might have been, I've never heard this, I'm just speculating, that the Marines were going to come in behind those 3,000 people, because I don't see how else you think this is going to win. Anyway, it was a disaster. It was a humiliation for Kennedy. He was young. It was early, first 100 days. He despaired. He thought his popularity was never going to recover. Well, his popularity went up. It went up from 70% to 80%. Okay. Because why? Well, at that time, we were in the Cold War. He was everybody's president. He wasn't just the president of one side of the political spectrum. He was the guy who was representing us in this terrible, conflict with the Soviet Union and with communism. And everybody rooted for him. They wanted him to succeed. Obama, by contrast, started Obamacare, the Affordable Health Act, and the reform of the finance system, the re-regulation of the finance system, and particularly, I think, Obamacare, basically they had all kinds of calculations about how they had the stimulus. The stimulus, they had all kinds of calculations coming out of the Obama White House, how the stimulus was going to short circuit unemployment, that was going to make the pain a much shorter span, and then in the end was going to bring the economy back to where it should have been. They made the mistake of putting down on paper what they thought was going to happen, which tells you they really believed in it. Well, it was a disaster. The stimulus, the economy went far lower than what they said was going to happen without the stimulus. But before any of that happened, people said it was going to happen. People distrusted the Obama White House, and his popularity began to tank and really settled in the high 40s for most of his presidency until the very end. Already there was no thinking, this is our president. No, this is their president, and he's trying to impose all these ideas on me. Whereas being elected president back in 1960 gave you a mantle of authority that people respected and tried to preserve even in the face of failure. Being elected president back in 2008 was the opposite. It made people large numbers of the public distrusted you because now you were the face of that elite that was trying to basically bamboozle the public.
Back in 1964, when the Beatles went on the Ed Sullivan Show, they had an audience of 70 million people in a country that had over 100 million less people than we have in the country today. When President Biden made his speech coming back from Israel and from the Oval Office, he had 22 million people watch out of a country of 340 million people. I give you these figures only to ask you, what do you think the impact of this kind of thing over the years will be on the future of democracy?
Yeah, 22 million is a large audience by today's standards. I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. I wish I knew. I don't do predictions. It's something we're going to have to learn to live with. I don't think we're ever going back to, I mean, the olden days, I mean, I was part of this. You know, the mass audience was like this huge mirror where the entire country saw itself reflected. We were all there, right? Today, it's like the mirror has toppled and shattered, and the public lives in all the broken pieces, right? All the fragments. And that fragmentation, I think, is as long as we have this information system, and this information system is here for the foreseeable future, is something we can't reverse. I think it's something we're going to have to manage. So on the one hand, there are many ways in which you can have a fractured system that in the end coheres into a higher level of authority. And you can do that by, not pretending to be what you're not, which is what our politicians tend to do. But it's not going to be an easy ride. I wrote the book precisely for that reason. It seemed to me when I wrote it, nobody was seeing this. And I am a pretty straight, coming from Cuba, I'm a pretty straightforward, simple-minded advocate of liberal democracy. I don't put any ifs or buts about it. I think the worst, most inefficient liberal democracy is infinitely superior to the most effective despotism. And so, yeah, I think this fragmentation, the fact that we all are going to live in little shards and not in that gigantic mirror, is something that our democracies have to take into account. However, let's be clear. We have always lived. The mass audience was a fiction. It was we weren't really satisfied with three TV stations, networks, or five or six brands of cars, three car makers. That was just an industrial system imposing its needs upon us. So the way we are today is closer to the way we really are. And the way we were before the industrial era, the United States was very fragmented way back in the 19th century and somehow seemed to survive with bumps along the way. So I think it can be done.
I've got to ask you about Stripe, the company that published your book. First of all, we don't often give our opinions here, but I have to say this is one of the most attractive, physically attractive books I've ever seen. And he's got a whole series that he publishes. You go on the website of Stripe, you can see them on there. How much does this cost if you buy it, the hardback version, do you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, Amazon bounces all over the place. But, I mean, first of all, it's part of my immense good luck that I ended up with Stripe Press. Because, number one, they're Silicon Valley, so they're design plus. The guy who designed that book, essentially a Silicon Valley designer. And I have to say, I had to be talked into the pink, but really is a very striking part. Many people tell me the first thing they say about my book is not how brilliant I am, but what a beautiful book it is. And that kind of gladdens my heart. It's $20. They basically asked me, well, what do you think? What do you want? And I didn't want to make it too expensive. I didn't know. I mean, I honestly didn't know. So it's $20 full value. Amazon, I think right now it's like $12. They've knocked it down to, I don't know why they do those things. You can buy an Audible book, which is a lot less, and you can buy a Kindle book, which is, I think, $9.99.
Who's the image on the cover of the book?
You know, I don't think the person – I asked. That they found it somewhere, but I don't know. It's a some sort of medieval-looking female sort of royalty, it looked like. But no, that's a really good question. I asked it, and I think the designers think in terms of images. They don't think in terms of provenance. So me as an analyst, is where does this come from? And they didn't know.
I did some research on Stripe, and I'm not sure I have the accurate numbers, but it's not a small company. And you mentioned that, is it James Collison, who is, it's an Irish-American company. Was that his name, Collison?
There's two Collisons, John and Patrick, brothers. Look them up. Patrick was now, I mean, he was worth, I said, $1.5 billion, but I mean, he was a baby. That was like, you know, a few years back. He's worth a lot more now. I won't even guess how much. The company has grown like topsy, many, many, many billions. It's one of the giants in Silicon Valley today. But look the two of them up. They are, again, part of the joy of my book, meeting people like this. Yeah, they're both born in Ireland. I mean, they're literal geniuses. These were kids who were solving the differential equations when they're like 10 years old, you know? But the company is an amazing company. I have been to the Googleplex, all right? I went there when I was at CIA. They gave us a tour. And the Googleplex is like, it's like Toyland, right? It's like you have these little swimming pools where you can take laps and not even actually move. There is volleyball nets. There's ping pong tables. There's computer games. If you go to Stripe, there's books everywhere. Books everywhere. It's like the adults in the room versus the kiddies, okay? So that's just the culture. It comes down from Patrick and John. I mean, it's an amazing place.
Do you have another book in you?
That's a good question. I don't yet. And I get the question a lot. And I say, and that's exactly the way that it should be, right? If you have a book in you, it should come out. You shouldn't just write a book because. And lots of two or three publishers have asked me, well, why don't you write another book? And I say, well, what would it be about? And I said, write them exactly like the old one, only we'll sell on more. And the answer is no. I mean, you have to have something that you want to say. I may at some point. I think the landscape has changed enough with the pandemic I may have something to say. But at the moment, no.
Our guest has been Martin Currie. The book is called The Revolt of the Public and the Crisis of Authority in the New Millennium. And we thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's fun.
Thanks for listening to Book Notes Plus. We want to make sure you know about our latest podcast, Books That Shaped America. It's a companion podcast to our 10-week television series of the same name. We've teamed up with the Library of Congress and selected 10 books from across American history that have had a major impact on our society. Each week, the C-SPAN television program will focus on one of these books and its impact. This companion podcast will give you more background on the book's authors. If you want to learn more about Books That Shaped America, go to our website, c-span.org. The podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts.